we have two really, really interesting CEOs with us for this session. I had a chance to visit Gail really recently over at Constant Contact in Waltham, and David, I've been following for at least two or three companies now, his entrepreneurial course. And, you know, the interesting commonality is that, you know, I'm developing a little thesis that we're evolving the innovation economy here in New England from one that was really heavily focused on selling to enterprises, and that was kind of the one thing that we did is, you know, sell to telecom and sell to big companies, to one that is starting to actually understand, as we heard in the last panel, selling to consumers, selling to small businesses, and figuring out what are the models to make that work. So I think we're going to explore that theme a little bit in this session. I'll introduce you to our two cast of characters here. First, on my right is David Friend. Last month he was named a Mass High Tech All-Star in the internet category. Mass High Tech is apparently a publication of some sort. No, it's a really great weekly newspaper and website. Sorry, Dad. Carbonite was founded in 2005. Today it has users in 120 countries and has backed up more than 4 billion files. Based in Boston, David publishes his email on the site so that people can contact him and ask him, tell him about Carbonite. He previously founded FaxNet, EAX and Nexus, Pilot Software, ARP Instruments, and Computer Pictures Corporation. And I couldn't find the total of VC that Carbonite has raised. It's about $17.5 million, or is that out of date?
In Carbonite?
In Carbonite.
No, it's $50 million.
$50 million in Carbonite. All right. We'll talk more about that. And on my left, Gail Goodman started her career at Bain & Company, Dun & Bradstreet, Progress Software. She was vice president of the commerce group at Open Market. And she's now CEO of Waltham's Constant Contact, where she started in 1999. Constant Contact went public last October. Remember going public? It was what, you know, companies did to raise money. Yeah, that window snapped shut. Company's third quarter revenues were announced earlier this month. They were up almost 70% compared to the same quarter in 2007 to $23 million. And the company has almost a quarter of a million paying customers right now. So, Gail, I'd love to start with you. Just, you know, walk us through a little bit the story of, you know, joining Constant Contact in 1999 and what kind of company it was. And, you know, maybe you'll also tell us a little bit about how your experience at Open Market informed what you were going to do at Constant Contact. And as you explained it to me, or as I understood, Open Market, you know, in the late 90s was this company that really helped pioneer e-commerce and raised a lot of money, went public, and then what happened?
Well, that's a cocktail hour story.
Okay.
But actually, it's worth, there are lots of lessons from Open Market, but I'll focus on one because I think it informs the Constant Contact story, which is we were trying to do a lot of different things for a lot of different markets. One of the things we were trying to do was build what we were calling commerce service providers. So people who would help small businesses build e-commerce sites. We weren't doing that directly. We were going to folks like AT&T, who built the Secure Buy service, and other ISPs and saying, hey, you should get into helping small businesses do websites. We'll give you the software to help you do that. We were also then selling to large enterprises, and we had a security product, and I mean, we had a lot of different things, all trying to go through the same sales force without any real crisp focus. So focus would be one of the challenges I think we had. But I got really inspired by, you know, this is, again, pretty early days of the internet, the opportunity for small businesses to look like really professional big businesses on the internet, right? They, you know, you didn't need the big fancy office somebody could walk into. You could have a website that looked really professional. And in fact, the first tagline for Constant Contact, which was then running software, was big e-marketing for small e-business, right? We're going to make you look bigger than you are. And so I came out of Open Market inspired by the opportunity the small business would, you know, for small businesses on the internet, connected with a founder, Randy Parker, who was building an email marketing platform for small business, and looking for, you know, a CEO, a business partner, right? Technical business, kind of a business partner, to help him take the company to the next level. You know, there were about six people, no revenue, a beta product, that was a generous designation, and off we were going. So that's kind of how I got started with it.
And we just tell the story really briefly because it was one of the stories I stumbled across, and as a journalist, you sometimes feel lucky when you hear the story. But so you had this lunch with Bill Kaiser
right.
from Greylock, and you said, like, hey, I have this CEO opportunity. I've really only been a VP and a general manager. You know, should I take this job?
Yeah, so Bill had been on my board at Open Market, so I was trying to make them network and get advice. And I was really teetering between the take another VP of marketing. Yes, I'm a marketer. take a VP of marketing job or a product-centric marketer. Came up to product management. Or take a CEO job. And so as I was getting towards the, had a few opportunities on the table, I called Bill up and said, let me tell you about the three opportunities. And he definitely said, oh, you know, that sounds horrible. You know, don't do that. And I didn't listen to him.
You didn't listen to him.
And then I have a Bill Kaiser story.
Oh, yeah. I'm always interested in discovering more.
Because that long list of companies that you read, my first company was backed by Greylock. And I took Carbonite. I knew Carbonite was not going to raise money on the East Coast. We can talk about that. But I took it to Greylock anyway out of courtesy because I've taken them every other company that I've ever started. And Bill said, those of you who don't know what Carbonite does, we back up your PC over the Internet for $50 a year. So I took this to Kaiser. He says, no. He says, that's not the way people are going to do it. I've got a server down in the basement and, you know, I back up everything in my house to the server. And I said, well, do you do this yourself? He said, no, some guy from Greylock comes over. And does it. So it was apparent I was not going to raise money for Greylock. But anyway, about a year later, I get an email from Bill, and he says, Dave, he says, I just wanted you to know I signed up for that Carbonite service. It's pretty good.
Well, did he eventually come in and invest in Carbonite?
No, I didn't bring it back to them. I've given up raising money in New England for consumer products.
All right, let's come back to that. But so, Gail, I like the fact that he did...
He did come back.
He did come back right. to your company.
Exactly. He sent me an email in late 2005 and said, let me humbly approach on my knees as someone who didn't see the opportunity and say, is there a chance to get it? Mm-hmm.
And would you just talk a little bit, I want to walk through some of the constant contact story and then shift over to Carbonite. But, you know, so you really did have to transition the product into a hosted service, right?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, we started, it was a server-based product, you know, traditional software, put it on a disk, ship it out. It was really clear that given our target market, that was not going to work, right? Because to run an email marketing service, you have to run a mail server, you have to be able to track 24/7, the application needs to be hosted somewhere. I mean, just literally when you start with, you know, focus and you start from your customer and design your product inward, it was very obvious it needed to be hosted. This was before software as a service was a term. And in fact, right at the point where ASPs were getting, you know, the downside, right, to go into a VC and say, I'm running an ASP was a bad thing, right? Because all the folks who had tried to do hosted SAP had failed, right? But we went anyway because it just needed to be a hosted application.
And there were some interesting points where, you know, you said we started to really attract a lot of customers as a hosted app, but we still really weren't paying the bills. I mean, it was a long road to figuring out how to make it a sustainable business,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so you know, similar to Carbonite, we have a pretty low price point. Our average customer pays us $35 a month. So I remember April 27, 2001, because I have the screenshot, we had 100 customers. Right, $35 a month. Right, and then we hit 1,000, and then we hit 5,000, then we hit 10,000. And still, just think about that, right? You know, that doesn't pay a lot of salaries. So there were a lot of milestones that felt great and really showed we were getting traction. But it took a really long time to get a low price point business cash flow positive.
And when you talk about there was one moment, I forget what the year was, but kind of in the midst of the downturn of 2001 to, you know, 2004 roughly, where, I mean, you said you were kind of within a week of having to shut the company down.
Yeah, so we got into the classic. We raised a really great round in 2000, led by a venture capitalist who shall remain nameless, who never should have been an early round investor, who then, you know, as the market tanked, they had to make decisions about which parts of their portfolio to support and which ones to not support. This was a firm that had an East Coast and a West Coast office, but all the decisions by that point were being made on the West Coast, and our partner was on the East Coast. And so our lead investor wasn't willing to do their pro rata, which just, you know, puts you in just the worst of all situations. One of our local VCs, Pump Up Commonwealth, did more than their fair share in that round, but the lead then said, you know, so they said, well, fine, we'll take up the balance. And they said, no, you have to have outside money or we won't even do anything, right? So things got pretty desperate. But we did actually end up finding a strategic who came in for just a little bit of money, but enough that that partnership would say, check, there's outside money. Even though they didn't actually lead or price the round, Mike at Commonwealth did that. Thank you very much, Mike. But as you know, it was just not clear we were going to get there. So at some point, you have to write the shutdown plan because you got payroll taxes and other obligations. And so, you know, we had both plans and we were just marching towards the date.
And from there, I mean, amazing to kind of recover from that sort of situation and get to an IPO, which was this. Yeah, sort of surprisingly successful IPO last October.
What was surprising about that?
You told me, not that the IPO happened. You said that the price kind of surprised you.
I was just kidding. Yeah. No, it was a surprisingly successful IPO.
Yeah, I think there's a real growing awareness in the investment community of the value of recurring revenue businesses. Mm-hmm. And people are starting to understand the difference between a dollar of revenue for a company like Gale's or mine, where a customer is going to be paying you year after year after year, and a dollar of revenue for, say, an enterprise software company, where the best you're going to hope for is an ongoing maintenance stream. Mm-hmm.
So would you talk a little bit about just kind of the concept of Carbonite and maybe, you know, I don't know how you would characterize Synexis, which began as EAC, but probably not the greatest success of your entrepreneurial life, fair to say. Would you talk a little bit about how that most recent experience kind of informed how you started Carbonite or how you built the company?
I wouldn't say. I mean, EAC started out as an advertising revenue play, and that was great at the period in the late 90s when that was a good thing to try.
And it was like free conference callings or internet?
It was basically working off arbitrage and advertising. And, you know, there were a lot of business plans that were floated at that time that looked like advertising was going to come, and it never did. So the company ultimately turned into a hardware and software company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with an okay outcome for people, but not great. The previous business that informed me more than that was FaxNet. Mm-hmm. FaxNet became the world's largest provider of fax to email and email to fax services. And we did that by being a white brand product. So we sold that product under the Verizon brand name, under Bell South, US West, Ameritech, a bunch of European phone companies and so forth. And it was a big company with, lots of revenue. And we had a little competitor called JFax. I think it might have been called eFax at the time. And they didn't do that. In fact, we beat them out on all these big deals with the phone companies, but they just kept plugging away, signing up people for $5 a month, one at a time. And they would advertise on the web, and they would get, you know, little businesses and who knows what. And we sold out finally for $250 million, which was a nice outcome. The A-round investors made 40 times their money. But eFax, which then became called JFax, kept going, building those one-off subscriptions. And when they finally went public, they were worth $1 billion. And they had, because they had a brand name, and we didn't have a brand name. Nobody ever heard of FaxNet because we never put our brand on anything. It was always some phone company's brand. And so what informed me out of that experience was there's really some value to building a brand name. That when you go out and spend, you know, $1 million on advertising to get your brand out there and drive people to your website, you're getting more than revenue. You're actually, you know, you're building something that people ascribe value to in the future, because our multiples were never as good as the multiples that the JFax got.
And so you just touch on, so the brand is a reference to The Empire Strikes Back, right?
That's our brand.
Yeah.
Well, it's Carbonite is, you know, Han Solo is encased in carbonite.
Were you concerned?
Jabba the Hutt's palace.
Right, and so were you concerned that by picking that brand that, you know, George Lucas might sue you?
Well, I keep hoping he will, because the publicity would be awesome.
So you didn't have to license the word Carbonite, or they hadn't registered the URL Carbonite,
no,
I guess.
It's, the URL Carbonite was had been taken up by a squatter, and we bought it from him. And
how much do you have to pay?
I think it was like 10 grand, so you know, it wasn't outrageous, but he was pretty pleased with it. I think nowadays he's probably kicking himself. But
and would you? I heard you saying to, who were you talking to before? I think you were talking to Dan, and you said a lot of the brand and a lot of the marketing is around fear. So would you talk about that?
Yeah, this gets back to Gail's comment about focus, which is, we have a bunch of competitors out there, companies like SugarSync and Syncplicity, who say, backup is just one of many things you do with your data in the cloud. You can share your photos with your mom, and you can, do remote this, and you can do collaboration, and so forth and so on. And Dan was asking me, why don't you guys have all the data up there in your data center? And by the way, today it's 15 billion files backed up. That shows you the kind of progress that we've made since you and I last talked. But the answer is you get a schizophrenic marketing message, because we throw a lot of different marketing messages at the wall and see which ones stick. And then when we find one that sticks, then we tweak it and we keep trying to refine it and refine it and refine it. So everything in our business is about test, 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 and look at the results. Doesn't matter what I think. Only thing that matters is what the customer is willing to pay for. And we found the only thing that sells our product is fear. If I give you a picture of my smiling mother looking at the grandkids' pictures, that's not going to sell backup. Comedy won't sell backup. Warm and fuzzy won't sell backup. The only thing that gets people to buy our product is fear. The fact that you might wake up tomorrow and your hard drive is dead and all your photos are gone. So when you see Carbonite ads, you listen to Rush Limbaugh or Howard Stern or any of the people who plug Carbonite, it's always going to be about, some listener is writing in with a horror story about how her house burned down and she lost her external hard drive and her computer, and now all her pictures of her grandchildren are irretrievably lost, and her tax records and all that kind of stuff. And if you're trying to sell a product that does too many things, it's sort of a Swiss Army knife kind of product, how are you going to market it? You're not going to sell, share your photos with your mom with a fear-based message. And you're certainly not going to sell your backup with a warm and fuzzy message. So, you really can't do both. And honestly, a lot of companies make the mistake of trying to do solve too many different problems for the consumer.
The one place that I noticed Carbonite being marketed was on the Jimmy Kimmel show, where he was kind of doing, spots talking about Carbonite. Was that comedy-based stuff that you referred to, where it wasn't?
He was trying to show fear in the ads, but it didn't work. And we've pulled those ads now.
And what were, refresh my memory about what was going on in those ads?
Well, he had, he's sitting there typing on his table, and what's his name? One of his sidekicks comes in with a mask on and takes the computer right off his desk and goes scooting out of the studio. And then Uncle Frank, dressed up as a cop, comes out and chases him out into the parking lot, and they race around in the parking lot. So it was funny, and the idea was sort of fear-based. But comedy doesn't sell our product, and those ads did not meet our threshold in terms of CPA. So, we're not running them anymore.
And how much do you guys spend on marketing, in a quarter or a year right now?
We probably spend $1 million a month now on advertising. And, those of you in the room who have political inclinations, you should try sitting at your desk with a check written out to Rush Limbaugh for $1 million and see how long it takes you before you sign the check. It was there for a good 4 days.
You were like, maybe someone, the cleaning lady, will accidentally sweep this off.
I thought about all my friends. What a sellout. How am I going to explain this to my friends at the Brookings Institution? And he is the best salesman we have right now. And his listeners, I have come to learn, they call themselves ditto heads. And there's a reason for that, which is when Rush says go do something, they go do it, regardless of whether it makes any sense.
So, Gil, would you talk a little bit about your marketing and kind of what you found works for Constant Contact? And you told me when I visited you a couple weeks ago that kind of you're still, the marketing spend is steady, if not growing, kind of into the recession.
Yeah, well, the number one thing, and I think we heard it echoed on the previous panel, number one way we get customers is word of mouth, which is great because it is essentially free. So as we, if we're going to kind of come back to that, you know, East Coast becoming a hub for consumer or small business products, it all starts to be about the customer experience, which isn't just the user interface and the product, but every moment the customer touches you from the website experience all the way through customer care and lifetime customer and customer education and content. So word of mouth is the most important thing. So customer sat is the most important thing that we do. But we do complement that with direct response marketing. We find Google AdWords very cost effective. Now, part of that is because we do have a deep understanding of our lifetime customer value. We know exactly how many trialers we're going to convert, you know, by AdWord, by time of day, by AdWord network. I mean, it's unbelievable. And so we're running that as a science. That's not art, although the science can be what do you put in your chiclet, but that's all testable as well. So we test like mad, landing page tests, where we spend money tests. And then very recently, we have actually launched national radio. Talk about an old-fashioned medium. But what we figured out we were doing was actually creating a category, and you may have a little of this challenge as well, which is most small businesses are not yet doing email marketing. And when you go out and talk to them, they really just have yet to consider it. They either think, you know, it's out of range technically, it's going to be way too expensive, or they don't really understand the value it will deliver to their business. They don't even know that it's customer marketing, not you buy a list from someone. Because their whole experience with direct mail is you start by buying a list. Mm-hmm. So we really needed to get out there and reach the small business audience, which is like everywhere and nowhere, right? And connect three dots. Your best prospect is your current customer. The best way to reach your current customer base is with email newsletters, and it's you can do it. It's affordable, and it's technically within your range. So that was a little more than a banner ad, right? I love our friends Vistaprint across the street from us, but free business cards online, right? I know what a business card is. I understand free. Huh, I'll try it online, right? Very easy value prop. And they'll still tell you that is their best offer, delivers for them over time. Free email marketing trial doesn't work. I don't know what email marketing is and how I'm going to apply it to my business. So we have had to find mediums where we can tell a longer story. We actually also do regional seminars. We literally get small businesses in a room and teach them this marketing method for free. We now have 11 of those folks. They partner up with the Chambers of Commerce, and they do free seminars. So this is a little bit of hand-to-hand combat, but we're doing it in very large quantities.
And what is your marketing spend monthly? I mean, is it comparable to David's?
It's north of David's.
Significantly north?
Just trying to do the math off the top of my head. So we did, you know, $23 million in revenue and spent 65% of it on marketing. So, yeah.
Interesting. The one thing I wanted to touch on a little bit because, you know, it struck me as really counterintuitive, but so you're this average, you said $35 a month, service, and yet you offer unlimited customer service. Call us up on the phone whenever, as many times as you need, and that would seem like a really fast way to kind of, you know, kill your customer value.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a great example of thinking about lifetime value and not transaction value, right? Because if you start thinking, wow, $35 a month, they call me twice, I lose money. You're right. You never do that. But they stay with us for 45 months. And they call us in the first couple of months. And by the way, if they have a great experience, they get delighted and tell their friends. Right? So on average, our average customer refers 1.9 incremental customers to us over their lifetime. I'll take a couple of calls for that.
And do you do that too, David? I mean, how do you handle the service issue?
No, it's you can, you know, we mostly use live chat because if you've got a problem with Carbonite, it's usually a firewall problem or an antivirus product or something like that that's conflicting with Carbonite. And so we use live chat and remote, you know, we take over your desktop using one of these remote tools, and usually our techs will go in and say, oh, you know, let me take a look and you know, the user will click and accept, and then we'll go in and fix it for them. But I have exactly the same philosophy, and in fact, the numbers are very similar. We get about two referrals per customer over lifetime, and our average customer lifetime is about 4.5 years right now. So it's very similar to Gail's. And if you looked at, you know, the business on this, I mean, one of the reasons we've raised $50 million is because the way the business model works is I'm going to almost spend $50 to get a customer who's only going to give me $50. But he's going to give me $50 the year after that, the year after that, the year after that, where my margins are going to be 80%. So when I look at my business, I say I'm acquiring somebody for $50 who's going to give me $200 back, and I'll do that all day long. But I have a negative cash flow associated with that because I'm paying to acquire you today and I'm going to get paid back tomorrow. So that's why, you know, you have to raise money. But as I said, I think the investment community is starting to understand these kinds of subscription revenue models, and they're willing to look at it. They're saying, well, you know, a dollar's worth of Carbonite revenue is not the same as a dollar's worth of, you know, revenue for some guy who's selling software in a box that once you get the buck, you're never going to get another buck. And so we've been able to raise money on very favorable terms to support that growth.
And when you talk about sort of why you felt like it wound up being West Coast money versus East Coast money?
Well, you know, if you look at, you know, sort of cloud-based computing, it's all on the West Coast for the most part. You know, I mean, you walk up and down Sand Hill Road and you'll find companies that have, people who have backed, you know, Amazon and eBay and Yahoo and Google and, you know, on and on and on. And, you know, they just, none of that seems to work over here. Mm-hmm. So people aren't willing to put up money in New England for consumer-based businesses until you've proven what you need to raise the money for. So, mm-hmm. you know, after I've proven I can acquire customers for $50 or $45, I don't need your money anymore. So.
Well, how do you think about what the fundraising requirements are going to be going into the next year, maybe 18 months?
For us?
Yeah.
I think we're finished now until we have some kind of either an IPO or a liquidity event, because we have a lot of money in the bank at this point.
Even if that's, I mean, who knows? I mean, do you have your predictions about when you think sort of, you know, we started to see, you know, the acquisitions kind of trail off a little bit, and the IPOs stop entirely?
I mean, we're not going to sell this company. Somebody may come along and decide to buy us, but it's going to have to be for a lot of money. Other than that, you know, our intent is to take it public. I mean, this is 5 years from now, 50-60% of all the PCs in the world will be backed up online. And so, you know, it's one of these wide open horizontal markets. It's like antivirus. It's going to be a huge industry.
And how do you think about your competition? I mean, EMC bought this company
right.
called Mozy, and you know, I don't know. How do you assess them? How do you assess any of the other competitors that are trying to do online backup?
Right. Well, I mean, the good news about the downturn in the market is that it's very hard for new companies to compete with Carbonite. And our VCs tell us they see business plans pretty regularly for companies that say, well, we're going to do kind of the same thing Carbonite's doing, except it's going to do X, Y, Z. And they really have very little chance of getting funded at this point, because backup is something which is kind of like a silent in the background application, and the best backup has no features. I mean, our product, you put in an email address and a password, and it just backs up your PC. So, you know, it's not like somebody can come along with something that's got a whole bunch of whiz-bang new cool stuff and beat us. It's all a marketing game. And right now, the issue is who's got the money in the bank to buy customers. It's a sort of a land grab. And so we're in a good position. Now, Mozy was the only really good competitor we have in the market, and they've been bought up by EMC.
Which I assume has, you know, a couple hundred million, a couple billion in cash
on
hand.
They have
a lot of money,
right? A lot of money on hand, but they're not used to doing consumer advertising because their primary, you know, it's not a brand name that the average Rush Limbaugh or Howard Stern listener is going to recognize. So it's not going to do them a lot of good from a brand name recognition aspect. And it remains to be seen how much money they're willing to sink into it. So we're willing to sustain losses right now as we grow the business. But, you know, the way if the accountants would let you amortize your revenue as well as amortize your expenses, it might look different. you know, and then a company like EMC might say, well, we'll throw $20 million into marketing to buy $100 million worth of revenue stream in the future. But they, it's hard for them to do it because the way the accounting treatment is for a public company is they, it's going to be a $20 million loss in this year. Mm-hmm. And so it remains to be seen how much they're really willing to put into it. And, you know, they have taken the company into more of a business direction than a consumer direction to date. Now, I don't know what they'll do in the future, but so far the only new product they've come out with is an enterprise version. Mm-hmm. And that makes a great deal of sense because EMC has lots and lots of enterprise customers. And it's much, everybody knows it's much cheaper to sell another product into an existing customer than it is to go try to prospect a new customer. So if I were in their position, that's what I would do as well. Now, we're going to try to compete with them in the small business end, and in fact, we do compete with them in the small business end. And we're beefing up our offerings on that side. But, you know, I think they're a very viable competitor. They're our best competitor out there, for sure.
I'd love it if, you know, I want to take your questions. I'd love it also, if, you know, Gail, if you have a question that you want to ask David or vice versa, you know, because there's so many interesting similarities but also differences between the way you're...
Well, you know, so one of the interesting challenges for our business is it is business to business, but really we're using consumer marketing methods. We had a tough time finding consumer marketing talent in Massachusetts. Yep. Similar problem?
No, well, you actually have a very good consumer marketing talent now.
Well,
and she's on our advisory board.
Took me three tries.
We're very grateful. It is hard. And I actually remember going out and talking to some VCs who said, oh, we would never back a consumer company in New England because there's no talent out there. To which I, you know, not, it's a pretty brash thing to say. But... you know, my marketing VP came up through the consulting ranks. Had never been a VP of marketing anywhere else. But he's a good numbers guy. He's very analytical, extremely smart. And he's learned what he needed to know, partly by talking to your marketing person. But it is hard. And, you know, you listen to the... I'm sorry I missed most of the previous panel, but, you know, it sounded like, you know, the idea of testing and measuring and so forth is really the essence of consumer marketing. And yes, you have to have good creative, but that's the kind of thing that you basically buy on the outside as opposed to the analytics, which is what you have to be really good at on the inside, and knowing where every marketing dollar is going and knowing what the return on that marketing dollar is. So I think you and I are in complete synchrony in terms of our challenges. And in fact, our markets really, even though we call ourselves a consumer product, our markets are pretty similar because 40% of our users identify themselves as using Carbonite for business purposes. And these are mostly Sohos and little, you know, graphics shops and things like that who are, you know, using a consumer product for business purposes because it's cheap. You know.
So at the risk of sounding, oh, lots of questions. So, yeah, Charlie.
Yeah, David, do you... worry about consumer cloud computing, Google Docs and its ilk, making your business meaningless?
No, and in fact, you know, we've had lots of discussions with Google and Yahoo and Microsoft and so forth, and they have shown very little interest in doing what we're doing right now.
I mean people keeping their stuff online so it doesn't need to be backed up.
You know, most people, our average customer has about 20 gigabytes of stuff backed up. And that's expensive to keep that stored in a cloud. And I would say, you know, the kinds of things like Google Docs and so forth, people are keeping a very small amount, volume-wise, a very small amount of stuff online. And moving stuff of that volume back and forth between your PC and a storage requires very sophisticated client software because if you just try to blast it out there, you're going to use up all your CPU and bandwidth and you won't be able to work. And, you know, so it requires very careful management of the communications. And what we're doing is, you know, all we're doing is selling protection. The only problem I'm trying to solve is, you know, if you wake up tomorrow and somebody stole your PC or you leave it on Amtrak like I did recently or something like that, no problem, you can get everything back.
Was that part of your advertising strategy to leave the computer on Amtrak?
We started the company because Jeff Flowers, my co-founder, he and I both had data disasters in our families within a month. You know, we were sitting on his patio in 2005, and his wife walks in, and somebody had broken into her car and stolen her laptop, and she lost 2 years of baby pictures that she never bothered to back up. And then the next week, one of my daughters calls up from college, and some friend of hers had spilled a beer on her computer, and her term paper was gone that was due on Friday. And so we took the hard drive out and sent it off to Geek Squad, and they charged me $1,100, and they still couldn't get the term paper back. So, you know, that's when it dawned on me that there was maybe some.
Okay, let's take a few more questions. Yeah.
So in the last session, we heard a little bit of skepticism around telesales. But I imagine you guys are in an organization for inside sales, it's kind of a backbone. Could you talk to us about what you think you do differently or uniquely, or the challenges of your business and how telesales works?
Yeah, so we definitely use a direct sales model. We call them communications consultants. And they're very focused on what we call the onboarding experience. You sign up for a free trial. They will call you up and help you get started. Because we've learned there's just a few barriers in, as easy as you can make the software, the barriers are actually an intellectual connection. How should I apply this to my business? And just talk to a human being is the best way to work that out. The way we've overcome some of the traditional, you know, sales challenges has really been by having a heavy emphasis on quality of call and heavy emphasis on measurement. So, you know, every call is recorded, and one in four, you know, every rep has four calls listened to by their supervisor or a paired supervisor and gets ranked with them. But they also get together as teams and share best practices, and everybody wants to be the call that's up there. But we also know our numbers, how many calls a day, how many connects, how much talk time needs to happen to make that call a great call. And then we do track retention by communications consultants, so we know whether they're doing a great job of onboarding or they're just churning and burning through customers. So it's metrics driven. It really helps to have an online business so you can make that between who they sold and what that person's level of engagement and experience is.